Hey, QSL, Dick, great explanation. I understand a lot more than he did now. I could always break down and buy one. But that's not the point. It's the challenge of getting it to work somehow, you know, out of junk. And I'm sure there's a pin where the manufacturer had for the boards that they made on these Yaesus that I could build some kind of circuit, certainly a sine wave, to inject on that tin. So I guess that's it. So then, thank you very much. K2MMY with K2RIW in a segment.
Yeah, back in the early days of, let me pick a number, 1975, when essentially no rigs were designed with built-in PL, and we all went out and bought these ComSpec brand name little printed circuit boards and put them in there. We injected the audio way downrange, right in front of the frequency modulator section, right in front of the voltage-controlled oscillator, by soldering a piece of wire, tacking a piece of wire onto the appropriate land of the PC board. There was no exact pin for it. As such, almost all modern radios will allow you to inject in that location, I believe. The only slight catch to that is I guess the possibility exists that somebody has built a rig that is so highly integrated where all of those functions are all deep inside of a particular integrated circuit chip. Now go right ahead on that one, Eric.
In the late 70s to about the mid-80s, the later part of the 80s, most of the manufacturers like Yaesu, ICOM, the PL board was an option, and there was a set of pins that their PL board would plug in. Basically, there was a little bit of a resistive ladder at the injection point where the audio hits the control voltage to the VCO, and there was another lead off the ladder to take the PL in. If it's one of those radios, you can find the pin and stick your audio right there.
Yeah, give me one other piece of information here, Eric. That's always bothered me a little bit. All of our modern-day rigs have a phase-lock loop system. As I inject the PL tone as far downrange as I can get, right in front of the voltage-controlled oscillator, the control pin of the voltage-controlled oscillator, I'm trying to make that oscillator move up and down in frequency at a rate of 136.5 between the amount of time between the up deflection and the down deflection in frequency. You are now doing something that is disturbing the VCO. The VCO is inside of a phase lock loop, and the phase lock loop is going to fight you. I'm wondering if there's a more intelligent place within the phase lock loop to inject that signal, because if you've got a really tight phase lock loop system, isn't it going to fight real hard to try to take the PL tone back out of that phase lock loop? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Now, each manufacturer has a different way of doing it. The loop gain and the actual bandwidth of the filter is one aspect of it. And it depends upon, you know, how much division they're doing from the frequency that is of interest. Some of the manufacturers use an op-amp to sum both the control voltage and a clamped at ground audio input. But again, the loop gain and the bandwidth of the loop filter play an important role, and how far downrange and division they actually do their phase sample.
Okay, I'm going to reword what I think Eric just told me, and that is, depending on the division number, and depending on and the 136.5 is in the roll-off region of that response time. So in other words, the phase lock loop is trying to fight you and not allow the phase lock loop, not allow the PL tone to be injected. But because it's got a certain finite delay time, the phase lock loop is getting old news, so to speak, and can't completely take it out. And by you readjusting the amplitude accordingly, can get just the right amount of PL tone. There's one other thing you've got to worry about, and that is accuracy. Many of the phase lock loop systems use a reference crystal oscillator somewhere. In some cases, it's a 3.5 megacycle crystal, which gets counted down to 136.5 and then converted into a nice pure sine wave. I believe you've got to be within roughly half a hertz of accuracy of the PL tone in order to get full response out of the PL circuitry that's at the repeater. Is that approximately true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, well, you consider what 2 to 3% of those frequencies are. That's got to be pretty damn close. It's like, I think you can almost swing ahead, but a good decoder. I know the comm specs are like half a hertz. Anything outside that, they get really upset. Now, I've seen some radios where they actually take the audio and change the slew rate of the entire loop, so that way it's less impervious to the audio that's actually being said. There's a number of tricky ways that they do it. I know in television we do something completely different, but that's a whole other story.
KC2 QAQ.
Glenn recognized. I'm slowly concluding that the right way to inject the PL tone, if your radio wasn't pre-designed for it, is not only to inject as far downrange as you can, but there's probably a way you should simultaneously inject a small amount of the PL tone into the phase lock loop system so that it's not fighting you, if you know what I mean. You bias it at a cyclic rate, is my guess, and to really do it right so that the whole system doesn't become unstable and start making slightly different waveforms. Let's see what Glenn's got to say on this one. I bet you've added a couple of conspec PL tones through some of your rigs back in the old days, back in Florida. KC2 QIQ, K2 RIW. Go ahead, Glenn. And by the way, did you go to Dayton this year?
K2 RIW, KC2 QIQ. Yeah, good evening, Dick, and good evening everybody on the web. I didn't go to Dayton this time around. It's been a while since I've been there, but. I've added PL tone units like the ComSpec, but actually more recently to old radios like the TS-700, but they already had a spot inside where they allotted from the manufacturer place where you could put something in individual tones, but actually I wanted to be able to adjust all the tones of the ComSpec unit. I was just going to actually ask a question, though, about PL tones, especially on this repeater. For some reason, the audible PL tone is very, very loud on the output that I don't hear on any other repeater. Does anybody know why that is? Back to you, the K2RW, KC2, QIQ.
I have an answer for that.
And it's also on a different frequency. I think it's 141. Go ahead, Eric.
Oh, well. Can you hear me?
Beautifully. Go right ahead.
You're absolutely right, Dick. It's 141. The reason why it's 141. So, by the way, most radios have a subaudible filter to eliminate the PL tone when you're listening to it. You've got in your radio, it's set for 136.5. Guess what? I'm transmitting 141. And your filter ain't filtering 141. It's filtering 136.5. So that's why you hear it as being loud. It's only, I think I got it set for about 300 hertz of deviation. I mean, the proper standard level of setting it is, I think, it's 700 hertz or 750 hertz. So that's why on this repeater it sounds loud. And at the moment, there's also some 60-cycle hum, which I'm waiting to get for the power supply that I used to run the controller with, and that's being taken care of, so it's not in the circuit. Between the computers and everything that we got there, we got a few ground loops. And also, I need another set of isolation transformers, which have been removed since we actually rebuilt one of the racks. And, I'll get to it. It just hasn't happened yet. K2RIW,
K2RIW. Yeah, I've got a beautiful question for you on this exact subject, Eric. A modern-day radio, when I tell my radio it's going to go into a repeater that requires a 136.5 hertz tone, 4ZPL, and the radio generates that frequency, and you made it sound like the radio simultaneously generates a notch at 136.5 in the receive mode to make sure it doesn't have to hear that signal coming back out. That's one way you could have been saying what you're saying, or the other way you could be saying is that the radio in its audio circuit of reception has a very sharp roll-off below, let me pick a number, 200 hertz, that all frequencies below 200 hertz are rolled off so that none of the PL tones get out of the loudspeaker of my radio in the receive mode. So which is it? Does it notch out that one frequency by digital signal processing or whatever, or is it by roll-off or something else? K2EJ, K2RIW.
Ah, magic. From a very early time, the ComSpec and other PL, private line, whatever you want to call them, the switch capacitive filters, okay, you've got something clocking them things at a specific rate. I've never seen one that tries to roll off, say, 200 hertz and below, and I don't really think that that's a great idea either, because when you try to do that in the analog domain, ain't so easy.
On top of that, the voice is going to sound kind of tinny if you take out all the low-frequency components, particularly from a male voice. Female voice wouldn't suffer as much. But the roll-off is not doing it. Now, by the switched capacitor technique, which is a kind of digital signal processing, I can create a... am I creating a notch at that frequency, at 136.5? And I guess some of the more elaborate radios, maybe you could tell the radio that the repeater wants 136.5 on the input, and it generates 141 on the output. Is there a really good radio where I could tell it that? And with a switch capacitor technique, am I generating the opposite phase? Because now the exact phase angle of 136.5 could make it a co-phase or anti-phase, if you know what I mean. It could add or subtract if it's not a notch filter. So there's a couple more questions wrapped into that poor wording, if you know what I mean, Eric. KE2EJ, KJM Mobile, K2RIW in the TechNet. Where are you, by the way?
All right, first of all, I'm just around the corner from the house. Motorola, General Electric, here at Johnson, they give you the ability to split both the encode and the decode. Most radios have decode. If you happen to have a radio that doesn't have decode, generally it won't have a subaudible filter. Take your choice. Because you're generating a 136.5 hertz tone, its inversion is the same circuitry that runs the notch filter is also generating the tone. That's why it's an old chip. If you look at the early like Master 2s and stuff like that, it's actually a duplicate circuit on a fake board. And it's not so neat in a little chip like it is today. Also, there's a company called Maxim that makes switch capacitive filters in a little chip. You drive them at whatever frequency you want. They notch. So, there you go. But the commercial radios allow you to use switch hands.
Okay. Look what you created here, Ray. A whole set of questions on PL. There's a lot more to it than first meets the eye. And you're allowed to come back in future weeks or later on tonight and dig deeper into it if you want to. Okay, I hope we haven't stayed up too late for Jim. KD2 Baker Hotel Yankee. What's going on there in Great Neck, Jim? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, tonight I just had a question about... I went to a garage sale today on my street, and I got this old Kobe TV, C-O-B-Y, and it's a very small, Kenby battery-powered TV, and I was wondering if it would be possible to convert it to amateur television frequencies, and how much work would have to be put into it to do so.
Now, there happens to be on Long Island a fairly enthusiastic group of guys doing fast scan amateur television in the 439 megacycle region, among other frequencies, maybe 435. KC2QIQ is one of them. WA2CDO is another. Let's see, Mike Cirillo in Wantaw. W2OMY, I'm not sure of his exact call letters now. It's been a while. Anyhow, those guys who are into amateur television, you're talking about analog amateur television. Yes, I guarantee the answer is you can make that work for amateur television by putting a converter in front of it. In fact, if it's a slightly modern enough television set that it does have UHF reception, one of the UHF channels falls very close to the 432 megacycle band. UHF, I said UHF, no, it's cable. If it's cable TV ready, one of the cable channels happens to fall very close to 430 EU.
W82CDO.
There we go. Andy, give us some words on this one.
Hello, I just happen to be in the car. If you want to see what it's like, I can show you, give you a demonstration, James. The frequency you want, or the channel in this case, your cable channel is 55. That'll correspond to the 426 frequency we're using. We actually moved. We've been down on 426 because of interference from repeaters and paging stuff. And if you need a down converter, I got a couple of them. You can connect up. But if you don't want to use that, you'll need a good antenna, though. That's the key is, Dick, and you know that, that the antenna system has to be good. But we could discuss that. Mike Cirillo's called W2OTA. He's active. W2WIA, Ed in Massapequa, he's active. And closer to you, James, up in Syosset, is KA2UWH. His name is George. He comes on from time to time. So that's it. We have a repeater also that eventually we'll put up. Hold on a second. I'm going to time it out here. There was a repeater on the Empire, actually on the World Trade Tower, as you recall. So that's going to eventually come back. And we'll see where that's going to go and how that will work out. But there's only a few guys that are active, but it's a lot of fun. Imagine being able to see the person you're talking to in color, live, and not on the internet either. Not through any digital means. This is an analog RF TV modulation. Dick, back to you. I just thought I'd mention all this.
Now, if his television set is a real, real old one and doesn't have cable ready and doesn't have a UHF tuner built in, by adding a down converter, a little black box in front of it, taking the signal from the antenna, which is on 426 megacycles, down converting it to channel 3, which is 60 to 66 megacycles, that's an easy addition. I am guessing that the set he's got might have cable-ready capability. If it can tune with cable-ready capability, cable channel 55, I think other than adding a preamplifier just to get a little bit better noise figure, my guess is on the reception point of view, that TV is going to be ready to go. I'm going to give him some words on my next transmission on the subject of antennas. But am I correct in what I said so far? Is he cable ready, except for the preamplifier to slightly lower the noise figure? He already has a working amateur TV reception receiver, is my guess. To B2CDL, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, by the way, I don't remember if the channel number is 55 or 59. I know it's in the 50s. Because I don't look at the number that often since I have a down converter connected to my TV. But if you tune to that, I'll get the exact channel number because it corresponds to an exact frequency and I can tell you. I just don't have it memorized. We're on 426.25. That's the frequency we're using. So all you got to do is, and you can look that up on the internet. There's a chart. If Eric is still on, he even knows the relationship between the frequency and the channel. But that's the way to do it. You just tune to the channel, and you're there. The key is the antenna and the feed line, and of course you know that. So that's the hardest part. To get the antenna nice and high, and because you want to get a good, clear picture, you don't want something snowy. And George, given that he's in Syosset Plainview area, he should be able to see him. Is that it, Dick? I think that was the question back here.
Almost. So assuming it's a cable-ready set and tunes the right channel, 55, 59, whichever, he's ready to go. Adding a preamplifier will give him a little more sensitivity. There's one other catch here you got to know about, Jim, and that is If you're doing a sporting event, we'll say, and if a couple of blocks away somebody's got a camera aimed at a bunch of people in a marathon, and you've got and they're transmitting amateur television, and you've got your little television set battery operated, and you're a few blocks away, they'll get a beautiful picture and you'll love it. When you start doing real ham radio with it, you're going to discover something a little bit unpleasant at first, and that is the audio you're listening to right now on 2 meter FM. That receiver of yours, because the human ear is nowhere near as critical as the human eye, is one way of looking at it. If you get a 10 decibel carrier to noise ratio, in other words, if the signal coming into your radio is 10 dB louder than the noise of the radio or the interference or whatever, out of your frequency discriminator and out of the loudspeaker or out of the earphones, you'll hear some very nice audio with a little bit of hiss in the background. So 10 decibels of carrier to noise ratio, which will give you better than 20 decibels of audio signal-to-noise ratio in your earphones, is very acceptable for audio. Television requires something a lot more than that. A snow-free picture in television is not 10 dB of carrier-to-noise ratio. It is 47 decibels of carrier-to-noise ratio for a snow-free picture. When you get down to about a 30 decibel carrier-to-noise ratio in AM analog television, it's a rather snowy picture. You get pretty good sync lock, but it's not a pleasant picture to look at. As you can see, a hell of a lot more signal is required to make a television receiver work correctly than an audio receiver. I've just given you carry to noise ratio. Let me tell you one other thing. Let me drop. The signal you're listening to right now from this repeater is going into your receiver, and your receiver has something like a 15 kilohertz bandwidth to the IF strip of the receiver, and in order to listen to the signal, and it goes into the discriminator, and out comes the audio. 15 kilohertz of bandwidth. A television signal is 4 megacycles of bandwidth. The ratio between the two is about 1,000 to 1. It's not quite 1,000 to 1, but it's close. In other words, in order to get the exact same signal-to-noise ratio, because the receiver is so much more wide in its IF strip, in order to get that fast response for the fine details of the picture, it's 4 megacycles of width. That gives you another approximately 30 decibel disadvantage. So because of bandwidth, the signal's got to be 30 dB louder. Because of signal-to-noise ratio, the signal's got to be 30 dB louder again, and the answer is 60 dB. I'm rounding out the numbers. That's 1,000,000 to 1. In other words, the television signal you receive must be close to 1,000,000 times stronger than the audio signal you will consider acceptable on the exact same RF frequency. You put it all together, you'll see that television on short ranges, or if you've got line of sight antennas and the guy you're talking to is 10 miles away, works like a charm. You get the trees in the way or whatever to knock down all of that 60 decibel signal-to-noise ratio that you need to get good clean signal-to-noise ratio, good clean reception on television, you'll see it requires a lot more rigmarole. It tends to separate the men from the boys.
Dick, I gotta just run. I wanted to mention one more thing.
Go ahead, Andy.
It's one way one of the questions.
Andy first and then Joe in that order. Go ahead, Andy.
Okay, I got to leave. But I just want to mention to anyone who's listening also, if you want to see ATV live, I'm going to have the ATV set up at Field Day, Limox Field Day, which will be the last weekend of June, just like I had last year. And it just so happens that the Field Day site is blocks from Mike's location, W2OTA. So he'll put in a beautiful snow-free picture, and you'll be able to see and talk to him, and you'll get a demonstration right there. So my suggestion is, if you want to see it, come down to Field Day. It'll be another reason to come down and do some operating and work a little ATV, because we'll have the setup there. Just thought I'd mention that, Dick, and then we can go from there. Go ahead, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, this guy Mike is a real good broadcaster, if you know what I mean. What he quite often used to do in the old days, and maybe he still does, when he's making his television broadcast, he wears his Hawaiian shirt. He's got this beautiful, great big poster as a background over the beach of Hawaii. And he sits in front of that scenario with a nice color camera. And I presume this is going to be two-way. In other words, you'll listen to Mike, you're looking at Mike's picture with his Hawaiian shirt and his beautiful background while you're watching his picture, and then when he stops transmitting, you send your picture from the field day site back to Mike, and he comments on what he's seeing and what's going on there. And in some cases, you can put the camera on your shoulder and go walking around the field day site and give Mike a real walkthrough as to what's going on at field day, and so give Mike the impression that he's actually there. Is some of this accurate, Eric? I mean, here we go. Casey, WA2CD, go ahead, Andy. K2LAW.
All right, I'm just waiting for the IDs and everything. Yes, the way you described it is the way it's going to be set up. We transmit from the site. Mike sees us. We have a camera. And then we stop transmitting, and we see Mike. And we go back and forth that way. I think this year I'm going to do things a little bit differently. I'm going to bring some other equipment down. And it'll be under a tent, so it'll be protected from the weather. So come on down, and you'll see it. You'll enjoy that, just to mention. I got to run because I'm at stop here, and I got to go out of the car. By the way, I was listening before regarding the oil burner mechanic. That was Uncle Willie, who lived here in West Hempstead, W2UWC. The guy probably that you were trying to think of his call before. Dick. All right, back to you, and I got to sign because I got somebody waiting here. WHCDL. We'll see you later.
Yeah, but as you went into the store or whatever, I did think of W2UWC. Uncle Willie Charlie, he used to call himself, in West Hempstead. A real good amateur television. And the other guy's call letters I had trouble thinking of was Dr. Reed Fisher, the man who I believe is the major inventor of cellular telephone, Bell Laboratories, Murray Hill, 1968, roughly. W2CQH is Dr. Reed Fisher, who now lives in Florida as a retired guy, but still an interesting guy to talk to. Joe, I know you had a question about this amateur television. W2RYY, you watched a lot of television in your days, both analog and digital. W2RYW, you got it, Joe.
Thank you, Dick. Is that 47 dB figure, is that reference to your local noise floor of your receiving equipment, or does that more equate to a specific range in dBm across 75 ohms? I always hear this figure, 30 dB above your noise floor, 30 dB signal noise ratio, 40 dB or 50 dB. I understand what a decibel is, but isn't it a ratio between one point and another point? What are those two points, or really what is the higher point?
If I start off with a raw television receiver, got an antenna looking at the horizon, in theory there's a certain amount of noise coming into the antenna. It goes into a low noise preamplifier on the television receiver. Goes through a mixer and an IF strip and everything else. If in the IF strip, at the point where I'm about to envelope detect the analog modulated signal for video, in that IF strip, where I looked at all the sources of noise, atmosphere, low noise amplifier, everything. If at the point of demodulation, I look at the peak envelope of the power of the television signal during the time it's transmitting a horizontal or vertical sync pulse, that's the peak power of the television signal, and I compare it to the mean value of the noise at that point, mean value of the noise, all the noises summed together, that ratio at that point of demodulation has to be 47 decibels of, call it voltage signal to noise ratio, call it power signal to noise ratio. We can get into a little bit of a discussion of that. But 47 dB of signal to noise ratio at the point of demodulation will give you a quality of picture on a real good display device, a real good cathode ray tube or whatever, that a trained video eye will say, there is no artifacts there. There's no noise, squiggets. There's nothing on that picture. It is dead, full, quieting video. A qualified person who understands good video will say, that is the best you're going to get. and it takes 47 dB signal-to-noise ratio by broadcast standards, to my knowledge, to achieve that. I didn't quite answer your question, but I gave you the best I know about it. Eric can give you a better one. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Probably what I'm looking for, Dick, is the actual number in numerical value within a short range. In other words, that figure of 47 dB above your signal-to-noise ratio, that's going to equate to some number in dBm across 75 ohms. That's sort of what I'm looking for as an answer, to sort of understand if you didn't have a signal level coming in anywhere near that measured on some sort of other receiver, you know you wouldn't be able to get a television picture. Would that be equivalent to 50 dBm across 75 ohms? Would it be equivalent to 30 dBm across 75 ohms? That's the answer what I'm looking for.
Okay, I'm going to give you a rough rule of thumb. It's my belief that a real good state-of-the-art television receiver across its 4 megacycles of bandwidth will have an amount of noise when referred to the front end of approximately 1 microvolt. So in other words, the amount of noise you see on that screen when nothing is going in is equivalent to about a 1 microvolt random noise signal at the antenna port. 1 microvolt is minus 107 dBm. 47 decibels stronger than that is minus 60. So a real good, properly operating television receiver requires a peak envelope power of the video of the television analog transmission. Peak envelope power of the sync pulses will be at a power level in RF of roughly minus 60 dBm. Is that approximately what you're looking for? And now you know how I got it. Over to you, Joe.
Yes, that's what I'm looking for. See, that makes it, you're talking about apples and apples and oranges. You put everything in the same, terminology to speak of, it makes it easier to understand. That's something you can grab a hold of.
And now let me give you one further example to again show you the ratio of how much stronger a television signal has got to be compared to an audio signal, an FM modulated audio signal. A real good FM receiver like the ones you guys are using right now, 0.07 microvolts is approximately what the sensitivity could be, squelch break and whatever, 0.07 microvolts, which happens to be 23 dB stronger and weaker than minus 113, so that is around minus 136. So a real good FM receiver will get an acceptable amount of audio when the RF signal level is minus 136 dBm. We just found out that minus 60 dBm is required for a good television receiver to be operated correctly, and the ratio between those two is a great big number. Minus 60 to minus 130 is about 80 or 90 dB of difference. As you can tell, good television reception requires a whopping big signal. I know we went pretty far left of center of your original question, Jim, but as you can tell, people are interested in television, and I thought they'd get a kick out of some of this additional information. Don, good set of questions as usual, Jim. 82 VHY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, thanks, Dick. I just have one more quick question.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time
out. If I round off that number, Joe, it's around minus 128. A real good FM receiver can get squelch break and acceptable audio at minus 128 dBm. And the ratio between that and a minus 60 dBm signal, I did it again. I hit the wrong button on this machine. There it is. 60. Good. Ridiculous. Ridiculous. I don't believe it. Ha! Still don't believe it. My calculator is lying to me today. Oh, I see what I did wrong. Okay. 69 dB of difference between the two. So, once again, by this other calculation, the television signal's got to be something like 69 dB stronger than an audio signal in order to give you good signal-to-noise ratio. I do believe that a real good hot front-end repeater, and many of them do claim 0.07 microvolts of sensitivity. Real good repeaters can do that. And that's 22 dB stronger, better than 1 microvolt. So you do come up with a sensitivity of around minus 128 dBm, Joe. I know, Jim, you had one more question. Go right ahead. KD2BHY, K2LIW.
Okay, thanks, Dick. Yeah, I just had a quick question. If I were to buy a single band, let's say 40 meters QRP band, how much would it cost?
Cancel. Jim, you said if I was to buy a single band, and I missed some of the other information. Repeat that, Jim.
If someone was to buy a, let's say, 40 meter or any band, CHF band, QRP transmitter, how much do you think that would come out to?
A 40 meter QRP transmitter, if it's Morse code. I think there was an article in QST magazine as to how to build one of those inside of a tuna fish can. So for you to build that yourself, a 40 meter QRP, you know, 1 watt type thing, Morse code, with modern day integrated circuits, I think you can do it for, I'm going to guess, less than $20 is a rough guess, Jim. Go ahead.
W2NDG, comment?
NDG, go right ahead and give us your comment.
Dick and James, I wrote an article. It shows up in two places just on this subject. It's on amateurradio.com called the Kit Roundup. There's also a link to it on my own webpage on Limark's webpage, limark.org. If you look at the blue bars, there's information about kit building by W2NDG. And it gives you a list of every kit source I could find on the Internet, what they're offering, and what the prices are. Hopefully that'll help. W2NDG, back to you, Dick.
And what's the approximate price for one of those kits, in your opinion?
It's a huge range, anywhere from $20 to $100. There's a lot of kits out there.
Okay, that's darn good information, Neil. Hey, thank you. Alrighty, we're going to move on to the Mel's Corner. What kind of questions have we had this week, John? And I'm pretty sure you'll be able to override this noise. KC2WGV, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGV, how do you copy, Dick?
Beautiful, please proceed.
Okay, I have a gentleman named Mark. He has a question about balance. And he'd like to know the particulars. Why are they needed, what do they do, and how do they work? I also emailed him back that he should look on the amateurradio.tangovicar and take a look at the balance information there that Mel and you had represented a while back. So maybe you could give him a quick synopsis on balance and what they actually do. So back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Very fine, John. Good common sense would lead you to believe that when I build a dipole, for instance, I build a dipole. Let's assume now I'm doing it on 80 meters. I would start off with roughly 131 feet of wire, cut it in the middle, and feed my coax cable shield to one side and center conductor to the other side. Or if I'm doing it on 40 meters, I'm going to cut 64 feet of wire, roughly, in the center. And on paper, it looks like that should work like a charm. The catch is that you think you're feeding an antenna in the center, and you think it's one single antenna. Mother Nature doesn't look at it that way. As far as Mother Nature is concerned, the right-hand side of the dipole is a quarter wavelength long antenna where you put some voltage on it with reference to ground. The left-hand side of the dipole is the other quarter wavelength of antenna. You put some voltage on it with reference to ground. As far as Mother Nature is concerned, they are two separate antennas. In order to feed them correctly, If your transmitter was making, let me pick a number, a 10-volt radio signal, you'd like to put plus 5 volts on the right-hand side of the dipole, minus 5 volts on the left-hand side of the dipole at one instant of time. Half wavelength later, the voltages are reversed. So you'd like to put equal positive and negative voltage balanced, right side and left side, because you think it's one antenna. Mother Nature considers it two separate devices that happen to be in one point in space. They happen to be operating with reference to each other. If your transmitter was one tiny little tuna fish can, like the one that Jim's going to build someday, and you've got two insulated leads coming out of the tuna fish can. One goes to the right-hand side of the dipole, one goes to the left-hand side of the dipole, and there's a battery inside the tuna fish can. He's got a small, completely floating transmitter, and he puts it in the middle of that antenna. It would work like a charm. And in the old days of ham radio, we hams did just that. We operated from the attic of the house. It was a wooden house. On the wooden table, you had a transmitter, and there were two leads coming out of the transmitter. One lead went to the wire that went out the north window of the attic of the house. The other wire went out the south window of the house, and the transmitter was sitting on this wooden table right in the middle, a completely floating transmitter on a completely isolated antenna, and the two halves are in free space operating around your house. That's the way we used to do it. Pretty soon, we amateurs got relegated to the basement of the house, and we got a transmission line going from the attic where the antenna is down to the basement. And back in the days when we used open wire line and twin lead, that worked like a charm, because that's a balanced transmission line. Let me drop. However, the coaxial cable we use is a unbalanced shielded structure. In other words, the actual signal we launch down that coaxial cable is between the center conductor and the inner surface of the outer cylindrical conductor. We're launching the signal down the center, and there is no signal on the outside of that coaxial cable when you're using it correctly. It's coming out of a shielded transmitter, the completely shielded can of the transmitter will not allow any signals playing on outside of the cable. You bring that coaxial cable up to your dipole, and you connect the shield to the left-hand side of the dipole and the center conductor to the right side. Mother Nature will take that signal that you had a voltage on the center conductor and no voltage on the outer conductor. That's the way you launched it out of the transmitter. Mother Nature, because she doesn't think that's one antenna, it's two separate antennas, she will rebalance it for you. You're producing 10 volts between center conductor and shield of your cable, and by the time you connect it to the Yagi antenna, the dipole antenna, Mother Nature will rebalance it so that there'll be almost 5 volts on the right side and the 5 volts on the left side. She will rebalance it for you. As such, the 5 volts on the left side of the rebalancing of the antenna is being launched down the outside of the coax cable. The antenna itself creates an imbalance that launches the signal on the outside of your coax cable. Your coax cable used to be a shielded structure. Once you connected it to the antenna in that manner, it ain't a shielded structure anymore. You think you've got a dipole that's doing the radiating. You're radiating with a dipole and with the coax cable. And depending on how you dress that coax cable, is it vertical, horizontal, does it have zigzags or whatever, it is part of your antenna. And you readjust the length of the coax cable because it is part of the antenna. You're readjusting the radiating structure, electronic length, and you'll get changes in the tuning of the antenna. It's not a showstopper, but it's an undesirable situation. You can easily have RF in the shack. If you're using a D104 metal microphone, you can easily have RF energy in the shack where, as you put your lip near the microphone, it bites you, if you know what I mean. When you create a balancing device, which acts a little bit like an isolation transformer, a current balance, you can make a poor man's current balance. And there's a difference between current balance and voltage balance. We'll have to get into that someday. You make a current balance by way of making three or four turns of the coax cable looped together near the dipole antenna, held together with a tape. That is a kind of an RF choke, where when the antenna tries to relaunch a signal back down the outside of the cable, the four or five turns of the cable that you've created creates an RF choke, which stops the signal from flowing any further down the cable. or you can actually buy a balancing device that does that for you. It's got a bunch of ferrite toroids inside of it into a nice structure, which also physically is a way of hanging the antenna, if you know what I mean. So balancing, in the case of an antenna, there's many places where a balance is required, but an antenna is usually case number one, if you know what I mean. So there's a whole lot of reasons for doing it. If you want the antenna to be more pure, and if you want it's a radiation to be fined by the antenna itself and not by the feed line. If you're in an apartment building and that coaxial cable, which was hot because you didn't put a balun on it, that coaxial cable runs down the elevator shaft and it goes by a bunch of other people's apartments, you're going to be launching by way of the coax cable a lot of signal into their apartments and probably giving them a lot more television interference. So back to you, John. That's a thumbnail sketch of why a balun is required. There's a lot more to the story. There's a whole art and science. There's a Grenadella, and can't think of the guy's name right now, wrote a couple of books on the subject of antennas. There are people of balance. There are people who have devoted a significant portion of their professional career to building, designing, and studying balance. There's all kinds of places where they're required. I just gave you one example on a dipole antenna. I'm pretty sure you can override this noise, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW on the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very fine, Dick. No, I'm sure that'll give him a good start. Between that, he at least has an idea of what's going on. If he goes to amateurradio.tangovictor, he'll be able to get a lot more information. And, of course, then maybe read a few articles. I'm sure that'll give him a good start. Okay, if you're ready, I'll go on to the next one.
Yeah, in fact, when you go to www.amateurradio.tangovictor, there's a portion on that website where the TechNet is selected by subject matter. And I think there's a whole section on balance where it'll tell you to go to this year, that month, that day, this hour, that minute of the recording, and you'll hear section number one on balance. See, we've discussed balance on a number of times, and there is no one book, one source, or whatever. The subject of balance is a fairly complicated subject. There's a lot more to it. So I'm waiting for a little bit of a delay here, and I'll pass it back to you, John, and we'll go to the next one. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. I'll hear you over this noise. Go ahead. I'll hear you over this noise. Go ahead, John.
All right. I've got a gentleman by the name of Pete. All right. Now, Pete wants to know about saturation in reactors, such as a coil, to an explode. And also, how do you differentiate between saturation? There's an interesting question.
QTH. Guy's potent. He's a potent mobile. Almost everything in the world, coax cable, ferrite balance, amplifier, almost everything in the world can be saturated. By that I mean you put the signal in there stronger and stronger, and pretty soon you don't get the usual response. As the signal becomes strong enough, eventually you get a kind of a saturated response. The sine wave you're putting in becomes a square wave. It becomes distorted. You get intermodulation distortion. So an amplifier will do that for you. Ferrite balance will also, each magnetic structure also has a kind of a maximum signal strength it can tolerate, beyond which it starts behaving in a nonlinear manner. Magnetic devices do it, amplifiers do it. There are very few things in the world that do not saturate. Even air saturates. You make the signal strong enough, and you create an arc in the air. So even air has a nonlinearity. Everything has, with rare exception, a nonlinearity. You can almost say there is no nonlinearity. of a vacuum. A vacuum, I guess in theory you could make the voltage go sky high across two plates in a vacuum, and as long as you've chosen the right materials that don't have multi-factor effect, you're not going to get any arc over or other undesirable characteristics in that vacuum. There's a whole art in science for not only recognizing that there's a certain level beyond which you get nonlinearity, but you can even quantify the magnitude of the nonlinearity. I mean, to just say that, hey, I hear some distortion, that I'm probably hitting the maximum signal strength that that amplifier can tolerate. That's one way of putting it. Another way of putting it is to say that a pair of signals, each running at 1 watt of power, identical in power output and, let's say, 1 megacycle separated, because of the nonlinearities of the amplifier, it's making 2 additional signals, 1 megacycle higher than the highest and 1 megacycle lower than the lowest. In other words, it starts looking like a Christmas tree on a spectrum analyzer. Those are called third-order intermodulation distortion products. So therefore, you can, you can quantify the degree of nonlinearity. That's what a third-order intermodulation distortion test does. By changing the strength of those two signals and or the separation between them, you have the ability to make a hard number out of the degree of nonlinearity. It's a mathematical function. It's called the third order intercept point. If you are graphing the signal strength of the two signals horizontally at the same time that you graph the magnitude of the signals or the magnitude of the distortion products vertically, you'll find that you get a particular kind of curve on a rectangular piece of paper, and up to the point where the intermodulation distortion products have a slope of rising signal strength of output versus input, they rise at a 2-to-1 ratio, whereas the fundamental signals rise at a 1-to-1 ratio. Well, because you've got two different slopes, they obviously are going to, those two straight lines on the graph are eventually going to hit each other, in theory, when you project them forward. And the place where the two cross over each other is called the third order intercept point. So each individual amplifier, mixer, magnetic device, or whatever, has a third order intercept point, which is a way of quantifying the degree of nonlinearity, quantifying the level of which you can plug in signals before you start getting an undesirable response. There's a lot more to saturation, distortion, third order intermodulation. There's a lot more to it, but this is the thumbnail sketch beginning of it. Over to you, John, and maybe there's a little bit more to that question. KC2WGB. I'll hear you over the noise, so don't worry. K2RIW in the TechNet.
RIW, KC2WGB. Yes, we had a further question. Would it be correct to assume that a circuit is trying to approach saturation at its particular tuned frequency? Would that be correct to assume that? Back to you, Dick.
I missed the one word. Would it be correct to assume that a blank circuit is trying to avoid distortion at a particular power or frequency? What was that missing word, John? Go ahead.
A tuned track to a specific frequency. He wants to know, is it trying to approach saturation to do its job?
And I think the answer is no. Most of the time when a person uses a tuned trap, he's using it in the linear portion of operation of everything involved. If, for instance, I'm trying to listen to a signal at 50 megacycle ham radio, and in the old days, I might live 3 miles away from a channel 2 television transmitter, 54 to 60 megacycles, the very strong television transmitter, 4 megs higher in frequency than the ham radio frequency I want to listen to, could give me some grief. I could then build a trap filter, which traps out the television signal, 54 megacycles. And when I'm doing that, the circuit could be operating in a thoroughly linear manner as a filter when it does that. No saturation of any kind is required. So calling the filtering function that I just described, or the trapping function, as a saturation? The answer is usually no. I think I know what's going on here. When it comes to strong, spiky signals you get out of a receiver, and you use a filter, I use a clipping filter that comes to, I use a clipping filter to try to get rid of them. There I am creating a kind of distortion or nonlinearity in that filter. But when it comes to an adjacent frequency that's giving me grief, I think the easiest way of looking at it is it's linear, not saturation. The filter, in almost all cases, a filter, a bandpass filter or a bandstop filter, allows certain signals to go through, stops other signals. And the first question the person will ask is, how in the world does it stop those signals? And the answer is impedance. Very few books will tell you this. If I built a filter that passes 50 megacycles, and I put it on the right kind of instrumentation, like John's Vector Network Analyzer, in his laboratory there in Staten Island. Let me drop. I built this filter at 50 megacycles, and I test the input impedance and the output impedance. That filter will look like a pure 50-ohm resistor at 50 megacycles. And I made this a bandpass filter passing 50 megacycles and rejecting 30 megacycles. There's another transmitter somewhere in my neighborhood at 30 megs, and I get this bandpass filter at 50 megs, allows me to listen to ham radio, and it rejects the signals at 30 megs. I put that exact same filter on John's Vector Network Analyzer in the exact same laboratory in Staten Island, and I measure its characteristics at 30 megacycles. I'll be amazed. That exact same filter at 30 megacycles, the Vector Network Analyzer will say the input impedance is nearly 0 ohms. It's almost a dead short circuit. And you'll say, gee, that's interesting. I didn't do anything to change the circuit. All I did is to move the signal generator to a different frequency. The exact same filter went from a 50-ohm load, passing the signal right through the filter onto the rest of my receiver from the antenna. I go to 30 megacycles, where the filter is designed to have a lot of rejection. No, not due to saturation, just due to filter characteristics. Just the way you set up the tuned circuits, the filter acts like a zero-ohm impedance. That's a few milliohms. But it's a nearly zero-ohm impedance at 30 megacycles. That signal coming from the antenna hits that filter at 30 megacycles, sees a dead short circuit, and all of the signal reflects back to the antenna because of standing wave ratio, so to speak, and gets re-radiated into space, and it's gone, and the receiver doesn't see it. That's what a filter does. It rejects by short-circuiting. 99% of all the filters do that. There's a whole class of filters that are specifically designed not to do that, and they're very rare. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick, very well. Yes, in fact, I have done some of those experiments with a sweep generator, and you could actually see the function of that filter. I've also done it with two generators set at different frequencies and could see the effect it had. And that's a lot of fun. And it's quite obvious they do work. Okay, I got time for one more.
Yeah, I'm going to add a couple of words to what you just said. I could now be using two separate signal generators. In my example of a 50 megacycle bandpass filter, the two signal generators, one of them set at 50 megacycles, one of them set at 30 megacycles, I put the two signal generators through an ideal power summing device. It's probably called a quadrature hybrid. It's an ideal summing device. It could be both out of resistors. So that now the 50 meg signal, the 30 meg signal are being added together in this power summing device, and out of the common cable comes the pair of signals. I look at that signal coming out of a common cable, put it into a spectrum analyzer. On the spectrum analyzer screen, I'll see a 30 megacycle spike and a 50 megacycle. I've added the two together, and if that power summing device is working real well, it keeps the two signals separated from each other. The 30 megacycle generator doesn't know he's connected to something that's got a 50 meg generator connected to it. The 50 meg generator doesn't know the 30 meg generator is there. The two are isolated from each other. Of this ideal summing device, and you and I have owned some of those, we'll sum the two together, and now both signals independently are simultaneously on this common output cable. I put that cable into this filter, and the filter is operating on both signals simultaneously. The filter is passing the 50 meg signal.